What do you do with the lectionary reading that deals with demons very unquestioningly and very explicitly? Multiple demons that negotiate with Jesus. Multiple demons that negotiate with Jesus and are then given permission to possess a herd of pigs who then commit collective suicide. I'm personally not at my most comfortable dealing with demons. Maybe you are. They're just too far outside my own experience of life. I'm more comfortable dealing with things that are well within my own life experience, things like mental illness, exclusion, things like ignorance, fear, and sometimes misplaced self-interest. So this temptation with this passage for me is to stay well within my life experience and to see in it the things that I want to see. I can't quite ignore the demons in the passage, but my natural inclination is to interpret what's going on in such a way as to make it fit how I understand life to work itself out. But of course, any attempt to speak to a scriptural passage has to be faithful to what the passage is saying and not to what I would like it to say. So a passage like this one presents me with some very particular challenges. Mind you, the passage itself isn't without difficulties, apart from the demons. The story is told by three of the Gospel writers, Matthew, Mark, and Luke. And while it's clear that they're all of them speaking of the same incident, there are discrepancies between the different versions of that incident. Matthew and Luke say it takes place near Gerasa, so we call this the Gerasene demoniac. And that's some 40 or 50 miles from the Lake of Galilee. So it's in that region, but they say it's near Gerasa. Mark says it happens near Gadara, which is only a few kilometers from the lake. So it's a more likely location. But he has two demoniacs, not one. And some of the older manuscripts, or the oldest manuscripts, say it took place in the land of the Gergesenes. I'm not quite sure where that is. So I have to ask myself, if even the gospel writers can't quite agree on what's going on, how am I supposed to make sense of this event? The specific details aside, what larger thing is happening here that might have some relevance for me or for us as a community of faith? If I were of a particular bent, I would focus almost entirely on the demons, the spiritual forces at play, the power of Jesus to command not only the wind and the waves, as he's just done in the previous passage in Luke as they were crossing the lake, but also the invisible forces of evil that lurk about and threaten humankind. And, depending on my particular bent, I would then either accept wholesale the version of the story as presented by Luke, not questioning the existence of demons and personified evil, or else I would try to explain away those things as the unscientific perceptions of a people who haven't yet understood how the world really works. Now let me repeat that I'm not comfortable with the idea of demons floating about, waiting to possess us in moments of vulnerability or weakness. I do believe that we're all engaged in a spiritual battle to live faithful and godly lives, but I don't believe that battle renders us susceptible to demon possession of the kind portrayed by Luke. And I'm equally uncomfortable with the idea of modern healers offering to deliver people of this kind of possession. And that's not quite true. I'm not equally uncomfortable with people like that. I'm not terribly comfortable at all with modern healers who flit about the planet in private jets selling salvation and dramatic deliverance. I'm profoundly more disturbed by them. But that's me and my view of how God's at work in the world. For all I know, I'm really just a smug, postmodern wannabe intellectual who's willingly blind to these kinds of spiritual things, to things that are just too otherworldly. I see things around me, and I make sense of them according to how I understand the workings of the universe. In Mark Twain's book, A Connecticut Yankee and King Arthur's Court, he at one point says, "You can't depend on your eyes when your imagination is out of focus." Well, I suppose my imagination can be as out of focus as anyone else, so I'd like to repeat a little experiment that I used 6 years ago as a part of that meditation. And I'm sure some of you are already familiar with this exercise, even if you weren't here 6 years ago. And for this experiment, I'll need a volunteer with good reading skills. 6 years ago, James Bugden was sitting over here, and he offered to take on that role. I'll ask James to sit quietly today and put the challenge to someone else. So what I'd like you to do is I'm going to unlock this text in a moment, and what I'd like whoever that volunteer is to read very quickly what's written on the paper. Not to get hung up on what's actually written on the paper, but to read very quickly what is intended by the text that's there. So do I have a volunteer who's willing to take this challenge on at all? Right. So again, a quick reading of what's intended by the text.
Purely Anabaptist people of a deep faith, honesty, integrity, and courage. They also tended to tick off their Catholic and Lutheran neighbors. Lutheran neighbors.
They also tended to tick off their Catholic and Lutheran neighbors. Thank you. That's exactly what the text says. But it's interesting, isn't it? Because that's obviously not exactly what the text says. But even if it's obvious that there are errors, that most of the text is in fact gibberish, our brain tries to make sense out of it and fit it into something that corresponds to our expectations. The more complicated and longer the words might be, the more scrambled the letters, the more difficult the interpretation becomes, and the longer it might take us to read it. But we do end up making sense of this, even though it's largely gibberish. If I had provided a text with only a couple of very minor and very subtle spelling mistakes, we probably wouldn't even have noticed. Our brain would have skimmed over the text and made sense of it without thinking twice. And we would have done that without a second thought, without any angst that maybe we had misunderstood the text. The presumed message would have been clear, even if the words were slightly garbled. Because our experience of language has taught us to immediately process certain things in a certain way. And as children, we might have struggled to stitch the letters together to understand what a word is. But as adults, we anticipate the result and we run with it. So what does this have to do with the passage in Luke? Well, in this story, we have a man who's clearly out of control. He's running around naked. He lives among the tombs, surrounded by the dead. He's feared by the people of the area, but he's so strong that he's able to break any fetters that are put on him. After his contact with Jesus, he's calm, he's lucid. At more or less the same time that this is happening, this interaction between him and Jesus, a herd of pigs nearby goes berserk and charges into the lake, drowning themselves. These seem to be the basic facts of the case. The rest is perception, its interpretation, and its explanation. The people of the area clearly believe the man to be possessed of demons. They can understand that as an explanation of his bizarre behavior and his unnatural strength, because that's how they understand the world working. And from the text, we're given to believe or given to understand that Jesus also accepted this explanation of the man's behavior. Luke has been told the story, presumably by somebody who was present. He wouldn't have been there himself. And Luke and his source also accept that explanation, that the man is possessed of demons. Or at the very least, Luke doesn't challenge that explanation of what's happening. Is that the correct explanation of his state? I don't know. But I also don't know if it really matters. I wonder if the perception of demon possession on the part of those present isn't simply their condition rearranging the letters to make sense of the behavior based on what they believe to be the nature of the world around them. Now that said, I know that I have my own conditioned rearranging of the letters that would find a different explanation here. One that understands this to be a situation of healing, a man of mental illness, rather than an exorcism of demons. And I'm not about to hazard a declaration of what's true one way or the other. But I don't think the message for us is that Jesus has the power over demons. I don't even think the message for us is that Jesus has the power to lead to heal mental illness. Let's look at the passage again. The people of this town were confronted with a man exhibiting bizarre behavior. They're convinced, based on their understanding of things, that he's possessed of a demon or demons. The demon seems to take hold of him from time to time, sending him into fits. And they were terrified. And in their terror, they tried to restrain him to no use. And they finally end up by pushing him away. And he, for his part, flees the company of a village that clearly wants nothing to do with him. And when we come across him in this story from Luke, he's alone. He's homeless. He's clearly suffering from something. And he's as terrified of Jesus as the people of the town are of him. And before starting to work on this meditation 6 years ago, whenever I thought of this passage, and I sort of imagined, you know, as you're reading stories like this, you have these little scenarios going on in your head, little images of who's saying what and how they're behaving. Whenever I thought of this passage, I guess I always sort of pictured it in a very dramatic, over-the-top, Hollywoodian kind of style. So, and by that I mean, I'd always pictured the man's response to Jesus' question about his name as being rendered in a gravelly, demonic voice. Sort of a, "My name is Legion." And I then pictured the demons being cast out as disembodied wraiths, floating about in the air, reminiscent of somewhat of the scene of Raiders of the Lost Ark, when they finally do open the Ark of the Covenant and these spirits come out and flit about. These pigs going crazy as they're being possessed and barreling over a cliff into a lake. A sort of a spectacular scene full of tension and horror. But the more I read it in preparation for that meditation, the more I think I began to see elements that I hadn't quite picked up on before. Elements that had taken a back seat to the demons and the crazy pigs. In my initial reading, the event then started to take on a very different tone. And yes, Jesus starts in this whole incident, apparently uninvited, by commanding the demons to leave this man, in all three of the stories that we have from the different gospel writers. But when the man grovels and begs Jesus to leave him alone, Jesus doesn't take a firmer stand, get angry, force the demons out, escalating the tension and underlining his power and authority. He doesn't do that. He does something else very curious. He gets into a conversation with the man. And he engages him, not as the container of demonic forces, but as a fellow human. And he asks him, "What is your name?" I think I can read a tenderness in that question that belies all of the other drama that might be happening around it. I can't think of any other instance where Jesus puts this question to someone who's been or is about to be healed. To some extent, it would, to me, seem like a bit of an irrelevant piece of information. Jesus doesn't need to know a person's name in order to heal that person, any more than a doctor needs to know your name to relieve your constipation. And yet, a good doctor will ask your name, not just to make sure he or she has the right chart, but to establish a personal connection with his or her patient. To a good doctor, you're not just a walking, talking bag of constipation. You're a person in need of healing. And the usual interpretation here is that he's asking the demon's name. And that may be the case. Certainly, his answer gives that impression, not so much in Luke's version, but in Mark's version, he answers, "My name is Legion, because we are many." But in Luke's version, we don't have that. In Luke's version, he just simply answers, not with the raspily, gravelly voice of, "My name is Legion," but perhaps with a gentler, sadder voice, simply saying, "My name is Legion." But in fact, he doesn't actually say, "My name is Legion." He actually only answers with one word, "Legion." And I think there's poetry in that answer. Legion. Maybe a pregnant pause so that the import of that to sink in. A pause to give time to picture the myriad of horrors that are haunting this man's mind. Time to try to imagine what it must be like to have so many voices in your head, pulling you in so many directions. Time to examine this man, naked, homeless, friendless. And time to wonder, what demons is he carrying inside that can do this to a man? A Roman legion, of course, is a regiment of 6,000 men. And some of the commentators that I read wonder whether this name that he gives is an echo of some sort of traumatic event that he's experienced at the hands of a legion of Roman soldiers. Some sort of an indication of post-traumatic stress disorder or something. Others, like Luke himself, attribute the name to the multitude of demons possessing the man. Legion. I suspect that what we have in Luke's account is a very abbreviated version of a conversation that occurred between Jesus and the man. The pleading to be left alone, not to be tormented, strikes me as another illustration of someone who sees in Jesus what experience has conditioned him to see. Here's another person out to torment me, just as the villagers have always done. Here's a man whose first contact with me is confrontational, menacing. He orders me to be something that I'm not. And so he begs, "Just leave me be, Son of the Most High God." And we're not told at all. We don't have really any indication of how long this conversation went on, but I wonder whether it didn't take some time. Time enough to reassure the man that his healing was a necessary and a positive thing. Time enough to reassure him that the change would not diminish him, but rather restore him. Time enough to give him a glimpse into the real nature and the real intentions of this Jesus, and to then accept his help. And time enough to allow him to get beyond seeing what he expected to see in Jesus. And I think we all tend to see what we expect to see in others. We then tend to respond to them based on that expectation. And our expectations usually are, of course, built on past experiences with that person or persons like them. So there's a certain legitimacy in our response to each other. But at the same time, we can read each other in ways that skim and anticipate and project. That's so typical of so-and-so. There she goes again. Will he never learn? I know where this is going. And where that past experience of the other person includes hurts, there's a very natural tendency to seek to protect yourself, to anticipate the risks and to build defenses against the other person. And the problem with that approach, legitimate as it might sometimes be, is that we then tend to see the other person as somewhat two-dimensional, primarily a source of pain or danger or someone to be avoided or held in contempt. We think we know what to expect, and lo and behold, we see what we expect to see in them. And those perceptions are really hard to overcome. And I think the challenge to all of us is to be able to engage with each other in ways that respects the fact that we're not one or two-dimensional, that we're multifaceted. That yes, we have our faults, we have our patterns of behavior, we have our ways of being, but we also have our positive qualities and our ability to change and evolve and to, in fact, improve. The challenge is to get beyond what we expect to see, and really pay attention to what or who is there in front of us. Back in the Luke passage, when the people of the area plead with Jesus to leave, the man who's been healed asks Jesus to let him come along. But again, Jesus surprises us. He doesn't tell the man to leave behind your father and mother and everything and come and follow me. He doesn't send him off with instructions, as he's done to others, to say nothing to anyone, to keep it quiet, keep mum. No, he says, in effect, "This is your home. Stay here. Stay here among the people that you belong to and tell everyone what God has done for you. And I think there's something very special in that. An outcast returning to his people as a man who's been touched by God. And I wonder what kind of reception he received in the village. Were the people of the village able to get beyond what they'd come to expect from him? How long did it take before they were able to set aside their old prejudices and accept him again as one of their own? And though he's now clearly in his right mind, to quote Luke, were they able to allow him back into a right relationship with them? I hope so. But it can't have been easy, because we tend to see and hear what we expect to see and hear. But the image of this outcast being restored to his right mind, in spite of his own fears, in spite of his own resistance, I think is a marvelous picture of redemption. And even if we accept that he was actually possessed of demons, Jesus' willingness to hear them out and show compassion, even to them, by allowing them to shift over into the pigs is also an amazing picture of mercy. Not so much for the pigs, granted, nor for the owners of the pigs. But it's an amazing picture that he doesn't condemn them to the abyss, as it's described in one of the versions. So divine humanity, I think, at work in Jesus, it gives me hope for the rest of humanity. To the extent that we can follow his model and take the time to truly understand each other and see beyond what we've been conditioned to see. To see beyond the hijab, for example, to the woman wearing it. Or, in my case, somebody like me, for example, the challenge is sometimes to be able to see beyond the support given to certain kinds of political parties or political persons, to try to understand the pain, anger, or fear that generates that support. The beauty of working with young children is that they haven't yet been conditioned to see and hear things to the extent that we adults have. They're still asking why, rather than assuming that they know the answers. And I hope that a circle like this at MFM is a place where our own kids can learn that it's not only okay to ask why, that it's to be encouraged in a search for understanding the truth. And in my meditation 6 years ago, and at least once since, I've told a little anecdote that occurred with my then four-year-old grandson, Elliot. He and I had been watching Walt Disney's film Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs together, and he had only just turned four, or was still three at the time. Now, you have to understand that Elliot's first language is French, and at the time, at that age, he understood English somewhat, and he spoke it when it suited him, but his exposure to the language was a little bit limited. And I don't know how familiar people are with our cartoon anymore, those of a younger age, but in case some of you younger folk haven't seen it, there are scenes where the dwarves are singing on their way home from the mines, "Hi-ho, hi-ho, it's home from work we go." So Elliot and I are watching Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, and these scenes come along, and the dwarves are singing their song, so I start singing along with them. "Hi-ho, hi-ho, it's home from work we go." And Elliot stopped me in my tracks. He said, "No, no, no, Papa John, that's not it. It's I hope, I hope." He'd never heard anyone say "hi-ho" before. So he heard something that made sense to him. And in this case, who am I to challenge a four-year-old's view of what to expect from the world around him? Elliot is now 10 years old. And a few weeks ago, we were playing badminton together in his backyard. And as you might expect from a 10-year-old, the shuttlecock was going in all directions, going off this way, going off that way, and his poor old grandfather is running back and forth, trying to return this birdie to him. So at some point, I finally said, "Elliot, come on, I'm old." To which he replied, "Yeah, but you're rugged." So who am I to challenge a 10-year-old's perception of his old Papa John? Thank you.